Welcome to Season 3, Episode 5 of Swift Over Coffee. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Michaela Karen.
In this special episode, focusing on interviews, we discuss how we prepare for job interviews.
So that when you're going to rewrite your resume, you actually know what you're going to put on it too.
Gosh.
We add your best tips for acing interviews. You're allowed to end the interview early. If you're feeling like it's a really unproductive conversation, you've kind of thought you don't really want to join the team or you feel uncomfortable, you're not obligated to continue.
Plus, you can be the tastiest peach in the world. So, Michaela, if I'm recording this podcast and I fall asleep in the middle, I apologize sincerely. I did a massive charity walk yesterday with my kids and my dogs, and I am sore. I am really, really sore and tired and grumpy. So we'll see how we get on, shall we?
I'm so glad you're sitting down and we're actually having this chat too, because I also just got back from Paris. So we are both like done a lot of things.
Yes. On one side, I've been traipsing through the mud trying to avoid cows, and you've been in Paris. We are not the same, Michaela.
I had to take a long flight to get back here. I don't know if that counts, though.
Oh, poor you. A long flight. Oh, well. And now she's in New York, folks, living up there. I believe near Times Square somewhere, you were saying? Sounds very nice.
Yes. I'm at the moment near Times Square. And as somebody who I like frequently kind of visit New York, I feel like I'm no longer a tourist and I will never stay by Times Square again because like New Yorkers don't go near Times Square. It's nope. Only tourists. Yeah. So like I have to go walk to like go get some food and it takes like 20 minutes longer than it actually should because you have to dodge tourists and it's been raining too. So I'm dodging tourists and rain and puddles and umbrellas. And like this just needs to be a video game like Subway Surfer where you're just like dodging people all over the sidewalk.
And I saw, by the way, on Twitter, you were feeling very brave while you're traveling around. You jumped to iOS 17 on the move because that's now out, right?
Yes, I did. I went from iOS 17 or 16 to 17 while I was in New York. I was at a friend's when I recorded, not recorded, but when we had the iOS Dev happy hour meetup. Mm-hmm. I was at my friend's and he has good internet. So I was like, yeah. Let me just download iOS 17 real quick. But then I didn't do it when I was coming home from Paris to the US because I'm like, okay, we don't want my tickets to get messed up for that. But getting messed up from New York to Indiana is okay. I can find my way home somehow.
And did you see they released 17.0.1 and then 0.2, I think back to back, like day after each other. It was extremely fast.
Yeah, I downloaded 17.0.1, but my phone still does not tell me I have 0.0.2 like available to me yet.
Oh, so I heard something about the lines of it's to do with the transferring from phone A to phone B. So it might be that 0.2 is aimed at the iPhone 15, perhaps, just for the transfer problems.
Ooh, it could be the transfer and the heating issues I've seen lately as well.
Oh, yeah. The less said about it, the better. I would say, though, I've also upgraded to 17, and straight away I'm like, ooh, shared passwords. You can have family passwords. And I went, sounds good. So I put all my important passwords shared now with my family. So if I, you know, get hit by a bus or whatever, they can have my passwords. And then realized I should have read the warning more closely because the family shared password thing does not work on macOS Ventura and earlier. And so on my Macs now, I have none of my passwords anymore. I've got to get them from my phone every single time, which is frustrating. And that's fixed with Sonoma in like, what, 2 days or something?
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm thinking of moving all my passwords too, but I didn't think about the whole shared passwords part and how that actually interacts all together.
Yeah. Unless you have macOS Sonoma, you'll have no passwords on your Mac anymore. It's a bit frustrating. But what have you liked? Obviously, that's a bit of a hiccup for me. But what have you actually liked about iOS 17?
I've really been liking, I didn't know this until literally only like a couple weeks ago, is that we now have offline maps, which is super nice because Apple Maps, I've been wanting this feature for like ever. And then I finally, I don't know, stumbled across it and then tried it on a beta device. And then now I have it on my like main device is the offline maps, which are good for walking around and like just looking some stuff up. But unfortunately, because I'm in New York, they're not good for transit because you need like real-time data to know like transit directions. Mm.
Also, it's fairly easy to walk around New York, the famously numbered streets, right? So I think it'll be okay there.
Yes, I should be good. As long as I, you know, can remember how to count, which I don't know, sometimes that's debatable, I can make my way around. Mm. Another feature, though, with iOS 17, like we have offline maps, which is super nice, and I've been wanting that forever. But a new thing that I was not expecting to actually like that much was seeing how people actually do interactive widgets. Because I was thinking at first, like, oh, you can just like tap a button on a widget, and that's about it. And it could take you into your app, or you could do like one simple thing, like play music. But seeing what people have been doing with interactive widgets has been absolutely insane.
And then you saw Pixel Pals, right?
I did.
Yeah. So Christian Selig, if folks who are listening haven't seen it yet, he really went town with Pixel Pals for iOS 17. There's a gigantic RPG in there now, plus things like the 2048 game and stuff. He's made so many extraordinary widgets in there. The map for the RPG was so big, he had to do a tiled loading thing to handle the widget kit memory limitations. He's really gone to town. Go and grab that. Sadly, you've missed out on the best Pixel Pals release because he released Pixel Pals 2 like one day after iOS 17 happened. And my daughter, who's 13, she loves Pixel Pals. And she said, downloaded Pixel Pals, went to the new food shop, because you can buy food for your little Pixel Pals now. To obviously, it's the in-app consumable purchase, so Christian can make some extra cash, which is good. And she said, look at this. And she tapped on the large food basket for $5 and then tapped away, and it said, thank you for your purchase, and granted her the purchase, even though she hadn't paid any money. And she ended up doing this several hundred times, scamming poor Christian out of thousands of these corn things and blueberries and melons and stuff. So obviously I told Christian about the bug, and it's now resolved in Pixel Pals 2.0.2 or something. You can no longer scam Christian. And I think he may even have the big meanie taking away her scammed melons, which is probably for the best. Thievery doesn't pay, folks. Crime never pays.
I love how quickly she ended up finding that too, because I didn't actually download Pixel Pals, I think, until the version 2, because I was like a whole week late to iOS 17 because I was traveling. It felt like forever. But getting to actually see Pixel Pals and using it on my phone and playing like 2048 that he even built into everything has just been like amazing. It's way more interactive than like I would have ever imagined that we were even able to do just by watching like the dub session.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Also, of course, last week, shipped the iPhone 15. Did you pick one up?
Because I was in Europe, I decided not to pick one up because I wasn't sure exactly how that was going to work. If you like go to a store in Europe, if it then gets region locked to Europe, or if they know because I'm ordering from my like US Apple account, if something gets weird. So at the moment, I have currently not decided to get an iPhone 15, but that's only at this current moment that could possibly change.
Speaking of Europe, it's very interesting. Before the iPhone 15 came out, like 3, 4, 5 months ago, a whole bunch of very angry people, mostly I think Americans, were saying, damn the EU, making us forced to use USB-C, it's a terrible mistake, da, 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 da. And now folks are like, wow, I can plug in my SSD external thing, I can plug in random, someone's plugged in a USB-C floppy disk drive, they've plugged in all sorts of things that make it extremely powerful, because USB-C just kind of works everywhere, and so it's a nice improvement, and I'm fairly sure there's similar device in Europe and the US. I think in the US it might be eSIM only, so you may not get a physical SIM card anymore, whereas the EU version does have a SIM card option.
Yes, that's correct. Because I know my iPhone 14 Pro that I have, which is also why I'm deciding at the current moment to not upgrade because I have the newest phone. Up until, you know, a week ago, I had the newest phone. But yeah, mine has a full just eSIM and it does not have a SIM card at all.
So I'm on the upgrade program. So I got a new phone straight away. And for the first time since I think like iPhone 5 approximately, I put a case on my phone. I've been caseless for, you know, like 10 years now, and I finally put a case on because I just felt so bad. With the upgrade program, every year I get a new phone, I get Apple Care, theft and loss, so any scratches, damage, they repair it straight away. But I was realizing every year I'm giving the phone back and getting a new phone, and the old phone will go away and be cleaned, wiped, probably resold, or like put into services as parts, or go into the Apple stores for exchanges when someone loses their phone, whatever. And I realized that when I was handing back a scratched phone, you know, back scratched or screen scratched, it was no longer easily saleable. They had to go and do a lot more work to make it actually useful. And so I was making all this e-waste for no real reason. So now, day one, into a case with a screen protector on, because I know it's going back in exactly 1 year's time, I'm hoping when I return this one, it'll basically be in mint condition. They can just basically futz with the battery a little bit and hand it on to the next person if they lose their 15 or whatever as a recycled phone. So I'm hoping just a little thing I can do to reduce all the extraordinary e-waste these days. We'll see.
That's funny that you're just now starting to do that and I'm doing the opposite of now starting to go without a case, because I always put a case on my phone. Before the iPhone 14, I had the iPhone XS, and with that one, I had an OtterBox case on this for like ever. I think I only ever took it off like a few times. But with that though, it's my phone would look like perfect by the end. And by the time I got a new one, actually I still have this phone. It looks like amazing. And like, there's literally not a scratch on it. So I'm guessing depending on whatever case you got, it should probably work for what you're trying to do of reduce the e-waste while I'm over here still making more.
On to our theme for the episode. Now this is a job interview special. So for the theme, I want to talk to Michaela about how we prepare for job interviews, all the stuff leading up to the job interviews. And this is tricky because I know folks are stressed out, they're worried, they're a bit panicky, they really want the job, whatever, or they're applying for many jobs, perhaps they've got a lot of mind full stop. But in that run-up, in the perfect world, how could we best prepare for a job interview? What do you think, Michaela?
The first thing I usually do with a job interview is just research the company, like not even super in depth, but just look at like, what am I applying for in all reality? Because, you know, you send out your application to a bunch of different places. So it's like you get back the interview. So it's just thinking, OK, which one is this? And like, what company are we talking about right now?
I wonder if some folks who maybe embellish their resume a little bit in different ways, they're like, oh, what did I say in the resume for this particular job?
I have done that because like not like embellish. I just mean like I change what I write on my resume every single time.
Right.
So I'm always like, which one did I send this company? Because sometimes I'll get every so often I get like emails onto this one email that I don't use anymore for job interviews. I kind of just have a very specific one for job interviews. And I'm like, how did this company get my email? Like my other email. I'm just like, where did this a resume come from that they have?
Oh. So yeah, I think because folks usually don't read a covering letter, like they attach it because it looks nice and they're looking like they're trying, but it kind of goes in the bin straight away. So at least adjusting your resume a little bit to focus on key things that company cares about. And, you know, not embellishing like Michaela says, not that, but just rearranging things or prioritizing different kinds of things the company cares about, say networking, more than some other jobs you applied for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found when you look at like the company's website too, if you do have like one company specific like you're aiming for, if you go to their website and look for their company values, like every company has like a list of specific words they use like for their company values and like big keywords that they like to see. So if you can take those words and put them in your resume, somebody will notice that like you tried doing something like that.
Wow, that is impressive. I like that approach very, very much. Good job there. Folks, if you hear nothing else, hear that bit. it's a really good little hack there, I think. One thing I encourage folks to do is to look through recent iOS news. Like just show that you're vaguely clued into what's current in the iOS world. Like if I ask someone, you know, what excites you most about the iOS 17 SDK changes? If they go, I have no clue. That means they haven't even looked at any of the WWDC stuff. They're not even vaguely excited about iOS 17. Well, they're not having SwiftUI or SwiftData, but anything from WidgetKit or something they thought, oh, that's really cool. That interests me. I look for that. I look for someone who's actually just tried to be vaguely on the news in the last sort of 3 or 4 months. They're just trying to do a bit of, basically professional development is what it is. Just research by themselves, a bit of learning. And that could be just as simple as, you know, skimming over the iOS Dev Weekly newsletter every week or so, just knowing the headlines, basically.
Yeah, and even if you are not like up to date with the newest things as well too, because like who has time to watch like the 100-some videos that were out on the Vision Pro, you can always just talk about a specific topic you have been learning lately. Like if you just learned the multiple trailing closure syntax, just noting like, oh, this is a cool syntax and you like it as compared to when you had to provide argument labels or something, and just like saying something about what you're currently learning can also work as well, I think, too.
Yeah, it just shows you're moving in a direction, and hopefully it vibes with their direction. Doesn't have to be, because you're at least showing you're learning, you're caring slightly. So obviously the big elephant in the room is coding tests, and you know, I'm not going to get into whether I like them or not, because I really don't. But many, many companies still rely on them to a degree. Do you prepare for those? Do you try and prepare for those?
I've tried a couple of times, as in I'm not a big fan of leak code kind of questions, because they're kind of like knowing the secret to the game, like Minesweeper. Once you know the secret and how to play, you like know how to do the game. And then like you can get to the end, versus when you don't know the secret to something, like you just don't know how to kind of get there. So it's like when you're trying to solve some specific leak code question, when you haven't seen it before, sometimes you just freeze up on like knowing how to do this, but you're like, oh, I could reverse a binary tree. I just don't know how to do like reverse a string or something like that.
You exactly nailed it. It's interesting that some people love these kind of gotcha questions, where you've got to know the answer. You cannot really, in the pressure of an interview environment, you know, people staring at you or whatever, on a whiteboard, you can't really come up with these on the fly. It's not possible. And leak code style questions, or any kind of cracking the code interview question like that, is a gotcha, really. And I discussed one in my book, Swift Coding Challenges, which is Floyd's cycle detection algorithm. It's famous. If you like cycles, you'll know this algorithm, and it's often used in coding tests, like an interview question test. And unless you've actually researched cycle detection, you won't know it. You won't be able to figure out the algorithm dynamically. It was vetted by this guy, you know, Robert Floyd. And so it's you either know it or you don't know it. You can't figure it out. You can't discuss it. You can't work it through. You can't share your knowledge and experience. It's a really boring kind of question to ask, and yet still asked all the time, because they want to go, aha, you didn't know that thing that I know, therefore you're not as good as me or whatever. And I don't see what the goal is, just to try and boost up their ego or something. It's really strange.
Yeah, and with that, I've always found with those type of questions, the best thing you can do is like walk yourself through how you're trying to solve this question. So I worked with one of my friends one time who was doing like career counseling kind of thing. And their biggest advice is just like, tell me how you're walking through that problem and kind of practice that. So like even like practice to like your parents, your brother, your sister, somebody who even like doesn't even know coding. It does not matter. But just be like, okay, I'm going to try to solve this problem. Just listen to me try to solve this problem and let me know what I'm getting stuck on. Because even if they have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, they can like say, oh, you're explaining this thing, but I don't understand what you mean, or how did you get to this part? Somebody can still listen and get to somewhere like that, rather than like they don't have to really know the technical aspect of what it is you're talking about.
Again, that is just pure gold from Akeda and her Akeda the device first place. No, seriously, because it's fine. You might not come to the right answer. You might not be able to guess the correct answer to this complicated question. But if you can show your workings, it gives you a chance to show off what you know, show your flow of information, show a range of other factors being pulled into your brain. Because that's where, in my opinion, the really good interview stuff happens. When you can expand upon things and go off on tangents and show about things you really care about. Not just like, oh yeah, the answer is 42. That's kind of dull. But we have to say how you got there and discuss and show, hey, I have great communication skills. We can bounce things back and forward a little bit. Is way more powerful.
Yeah, it definitely is, because that's really when you picture it. That's what's going to be happening when you're at the job, is you will be talking with your coworkers about some kind of technical problem and what is the best way to solve this issue or something. It's, do we do option A? Do we do option B? What are the reasons, given our like code architecture, we're trying to decide which one to do?
Yes. Another good tip I heard from someone, and this doesn't apply so much to Swift, a little bit still sadly, but not so much, is when someone asks you a question, ask clarifying questions back until you grind them down to the dust. And the example was, it was someone doing a C programming interview, and it was like, write some code to measure the length of a string. And he went, well, is it an ASCII string or a UTF-8 string? Is it stored in memory right now? Do I have to load it from disk right now? Is it a pointer to the string? Is it a C++ style string? Da, da, da. And okay, I get it. You understand strings very, very well by the end of it, just by asking questions about the clarification. And I guess in Swift, it's not so much of a pain, but I'm sure there's some holes you can get into very quickly if you wanted to.
Yeah, it's always about figuring out. They want you to ask questions too, typically. So like they'll kind of give you part of something and then they want you to ask questions so that you can figure out where the right answer sort of is. And even if you're not going the right answer, given the information that you have, you can say, when they give you the right answer, you could be like, oh, I thought I had this XYZ assumption and that's why I chose this way, which gives you like shows them what all the reasoning is, which again is what we've been talking about of explain how you got to your solution. And that's really what they're actually looking for in the interview, is just seeing how you work through problems more so than if you actually get to the solution.
For sure. One other thing I want to say is that, preparing for an interview, actually handling the interview is definitely a skill in its own right. Obviously being good at coding or being good at communication, that stuff matters, but knowing how to put yourself in the right mindset, knowing how to have some answers prepared ahead of time to questions you think might come up, knowing how to prepare your portfolio to make it presentable, whatever. There's a whole bunch of skills just in the preparation stage which aren't technical. They're not coding based.
Yeah, definitely. I always think of interviewing. It's a whole process, really, because you have like your first initial interview. Somebody may or may not be technical who's doing that interview too. So they're just trying to figure out like what kind of things do you know, and do you know the kind of things that they're looking for? So it's once you know what's each step of the interview process, like your first intro call, doing like a deep technical interview, and then doing like a more meet the team kind of thing. Once you know which step you're in and what they're trying to find in each of those steps, it starts like you start understanding like how the whole process is going on.
So would you say you adapt your approach? When you're preparing for interviews, you adapt to each stage differently?
I would say relatively. Like I always know when I'm going into an interview, like one of the main things I always do is like research the company of what am I doing? Because you have to know like where you're interviewing and at least what the company does. Like you can't really go into the interview not knowing what they do. Otherwise, they're kind of just like, they ask you, why are you here? And your answer is, well, to pay the bills. And it's like, well, that is the answer. It's also, you're going to end up working with these people like 40 hours out of the week. You at least need to somewhat like them in the end. But I would kind of adapt mine given whatever situation I know I'm about to be in. So like, preparing for your technical interview, if you can sometimes ask questions beforehand, like you went through the first intro interview phase and then you're now about to go into the technical interview phase, you can sometimes ask what is the style of questions they're going to give you. And then based on that question, you can then kind of prepare accordingly.
Yeah, because they might want to, I mean, the ideal kind of question they're aiming for is a whole behavioral kind of thing. Describe a time when you were faced with time pressure or when you had to learn some new iOS technology. Show me some example. Walk me through what it looked like to you. And that, if that's the goal, if that's what they'll be asking you, you want to prepare ahead of time. Sit down and think, okay, I worked on project A where this happened and I used this code here. And project B, I had to have a leadership role for a little while or had to resolve some conflict, whatever. You know, think of actual examples from your past ready for that kind of question. And it's very different from, you know, show me the code, solve coding problems kind of question. Very different kind of preparation entirely, I think.
Yeah, and something I do to prepare for that and just like for my career in general is, and I don't know if I've ever actually said this anywhere, but I've told some people, is I write down what I do at work every single day. I can tell you what I've done at work from 2018 until now, like no matter what day it was. I can tell you who I talked to and just like a general idea of what I did. And then I write a weekly summary at the end of the week. And then I like title it and everything. So I can tell you like over the course of a year, I can see how I've moved from one project to another, how I did something here and there. And just like, I could search somebody's name and be like, oh yeah, I talked to this person like every other day. So like I write down what I do throughout like every day of just like bullet points, not like writing a full on book or anything. It becomes a book, but it's just bullet points of what I'm doing so that when it comes time to looking for a job, then I can always look back and be like, oh yeah, I worked on this project at work for like 6 to 9 months and I forgot it was that long. But you can then see like what features you worked on and start really breaking down like finding very measurable things that you did at work that like you kind of just don't think of day to day, so that when you're going to rewrite your resume, you actually know what you're going to put on it too.
Gosh, that's like 3 for 3 big hitters goal stuff here. It's incredible. Seriously, years ago, like what, 9, whatever it was years ago, I applied to become a chartered engineer, which is a protected term here in the UK, for someone who's passed various qualifications. So I'm officially Paul Hudson CEng behind my name. But as part of that, they ask you a bunch of questions. You write a gigantic sort of 10,000 word essay answering various questions. Things like, how have you mentored others? How have you taken care for the environment? How have you, again and again and again? And I'm like, how have I taken care of the environment? Like in a from a coding perspective, not obviously like, you know, I recycle stuff, but have I actually tried to look after the environment? And I hadn't done what you've just been saying you do, which is to write things down. And I had to dig and dig and dig through code and memories and talk to folks. Oh yeah. Again, 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 to find things. Because what happens is you solve a problem. It's really, really hard. You research for it. You work, you debug, you fix it. And then you do it again for the next problem. Mm-hmm. And then again, and again, and again, and again. And you just totally lose track of all the great things you've done in the past. Damn it. I wish I'd done that like 10 years ago. I'd have saved so much time.
Yeah, I've heard, I think it was in a career thing or something or at college. People call it like a brag book. So it's like the things to brag about. So it's just like, oh, you were the one who made the flagship feature of an app too. So it's like you write it down as like, I was the one who did this thing. And then also, if you're having a really bad day, you can go back and look at this being like, okay, maybe having like a really bad day today, but looking back at the last year, oh yeah, I did all these things. So it can make you also feel better about yourself.
Come for the Swift stuff, stay for the life lessons, folks.
So after talking about all the things that we do to prepare, we also asked everybody else, what is your best advice for job interviews? And this can be something that is technical or non-technical, because like we've been talking, there's multiple different parts to the job interview process. But one of the first ones that really stuck out to me was Martin Lazick of WishKit had said that having an app on the App Store, even if it's just a twist on a to-do app, to him shows you the physical proof of your ability. Versus somebody who only applies and has theoretical proof based on what's on their resume, having an app just gives you a leg up. And I definitely agree it's really good to just be able to write like available on the App Store. It feels like nice to have that on your resume because it shows somebody like, hey, I did something, more than just saying that, oh, I tried to do something and I tried to learn something, but nobody knows until they actually talk to you whether or not you actually know what that thing is.
Oh gosh, for sure. I mean, so once folks finish the 100 Days of Swifty Y, most of them go on to this course I've made called the Ultimate Portfolio App, available through Hacking Swift Plus. And we build in there a really simple app. We build Apple's feedback app for macOS and watchOS and iOS. And it's not a complicated app. It has Core Data and CloudKit. But we go into all the nitty-gritty details. How do you make great voiceover? How do you localize all your strings? How do you clean up your code? How do you add Swiftlint? How do you document it? How do you add testing for unit tests and UI testing? How do you performance testing? How do you do MVVM? We do all sorts of things around it to create a small but perfect copy of Apple's feedback app. Because it means that you can talk about all these kinds of skills you've got around, you know, testing MVVM, whatever, as opposed to, oh, here's some really brilliant, fancy animation I've made, which is useless for voiceover or something like that. Because I think companies value that. They want to see your app actually running. And just saying, oh, it's a to-do app, doesn't matter. If it's a good to-do app, as in it works, it's crash-free, it has interesting features, it has whatever, that counts a heck of a lot versus, you know, some fancy pants visual design you've made, whatever. That's nice, but he's right. Martin's absolutely right. You get a leg up here by actually showing something real.
Yeah, and even if it's just a to-do app starts simple of you have a title and a a done button or something. But if you wanted to add like reminders in that, you immediately have to start dealing with date and time zones. And that in and of itself is a whole can of worms.
Yeah.
But Adrian Eves also mentions that it might seem unconventional, but don't be afraid to be honest. He was once in a mind kind of problem. He paused to admit to let them know that he was a little like out of control, wasn't sure like where he was going. So he stated the intent that he would like to just approach the problem again in a simpler way if time had permitted. And he said that that ended up going over really well.
Yes. So what, during the pandemic? Remember Clubhouse?
When that yeah, I remember that.
Oh, I know. Such a long time ago. I did like informal sort of weekly interview practice on Clubhouse for folks just to try things out. And what I told them again and again and again was the structure to answer questions. Give them the simplest possible answer you can first, and then go into detail with examples and more. But don't go straight into a big example. Give them the simplest thing and say, hey, this isn't a great performance thing. It's a simple solution. It will work, but it's good enough for now. And if I were to do another minute or two, I'd add this instead. Don't go for the big solution first, because you can spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes and kind of get lost somewhere, rather than having a simple bad answer you can improve upon.
Yeah, that's a really good way, because that's what we talked about last time, which is like start small and iterate.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Daniela, Sean McCains, and Daniel Steinberg all say that don't forget that you are also interviewing for the job, meaning you are interviewing them. So if something doesn't feel right during the interview, you're probably right. And if you get a chance to talk to a future manager and you're not sure you could work with them, it's probably better to move on. And with this, I definitely think that knowing that you are also in that position of power of you are also interviewing this company because you're the one that has to work with them too. Like, don't forget that part, because that's very important throughout like the whole process, is that if you just end up talking to somebody that you were just very incompatible with and later find out that they're going to be the coworker that you work with every day, do you really want to work with them? It's kind of a question you have to ask yourself.
I think for me, more critically, it's that if you're sitting here thinking, wow, this interview thing they've got going here, I don't know, coding tests, whatever the interview process is, you're sitting there thinking, wow, this really sucks. Keep in mind, everyone who works there passed that interview process. And so that's who you'll be working with. People who think this is a great interview process, they want to work there. And so that put me away for sure. If someone said, oh yeah, now let's do a big whiteboard coding test. Oh, so you hire that kind of person. Okay. Actually, speaking of which, I want to throw in, before we move on, my favorite tip for interviews. Like, when you're actually in the interview room, it's the simplest thing, and it is so powerful. When they say at the beginning, they say, hey, oh, hey, Paul, how are you doing? Da-da-da. Would you like some coffee or some water? Or if you're in the UK, would you like some tea? You say yes. Whatever they say, you say yes, I'd have a drink, please, because you get your coffee. And they'll ask you, oh, so tell us about a time when you used MVVM, whatever. You can go, oh, that's a good question. Take a long, slow sip of your coffee, think about it, and then answer. The drink is there not to quench your thirst, but to give you a nice little fire break between them asking a hard question and you want to answer the question. You're rearranging the words, finding the exact scenarios in your head, but it looks smart, it looks natural, you know, you're very wise, taking your time, and then answer, as opposed to sort of staring into space and going, like
that's
that.
A really good tip. I remember I asked the person who interviewed me for my very first job that I had, I asked them like, oh, what do you remember about me when I did the interview? And he literally told me, he was like, you sped through that interview. The interview should have lasted like an hour and it took me like 20 minutes.
Which is a good sign in its own way, but it could be a bit of nerves too, you know?
It was definitely nerves. I remember thinking of how big these people looked like behind, because they're just like staring at you the whole time. Mm. And that just is freaky. So I like just was nervous and would answer everything super, super quickly and was like, okay, that's it. That's the answer. Let's move on to the next one. And that's all. That's one of the things that they did remember too, was they were like, you just went through that interview so fast because I was also nervous and talking quickly. But if I would have had a drink, I feel like instead of 20 minutes, maybe it would have been 30 minutes.
Yeah, like 21 minutes perhaps.
Exactly. But it does give you time to think at least, because you have to swallow. And then like if you take a big sip or the coffee is hot, you can then talk about like something like that. Brittany also mentions that something that helps her a ton is to have the confidence in what you know and to use the interview as an opportunity to learn and show kindness. The interviewer is human too, and they can feel that you've accomplished something no matter what the outcome is.
So, wow, yeah, this is not something I'm great at. I think the natural sort of fight or flight, you know, tenseness, anxiety you get for going for a job, because, you know, you want the job, right? You're stressed out. You want the job. You want to fight for the job. Thinking about the other person, God, I don't think I'm mature enough for that yet. Honestly, I think I'm not quite there in my emotional growth as a human, because I'm going in, you know, I'm worried, I'm stressed out, I'm trying to remember what my great answers I prepared ahead of time, and to show kindness to the interviewer. I mean, maybe if they're having a hard time, if I see they're struggling or they're nervous too, fine, I can do that. But if it's, as I said earlier, you know, bunch of dudes behind a desk staring at you, I struggle to humanize that a little bit, and that's on me. I should probably be better at that. But I do agree very clearly, of course, with the have confidence in what you know. That's a big one, because you've got to know what you're good at and stick to that and be comfortable knowing, yeah, this bit I'm actually really, really good at. And remember, as a phrase I love, you can be the tastiest peach in the world and still meet someone who doesn't like peaches. Because you can be great at a particular thing, but you meet someone who just doesn't want that thing, and that's okay.
I love that. I love that saying. I've never heard that, but that is great. Along with what Brittany said too, it's I like to think when I was interviewing interns at one of my previous jobs, I would try to like smile at the person that we're interviewing so that they know we're not just like sitting there writing down everything that they're saying onto a piece of paper, even though we are, because we have to remember it afterwards.
Yeah.
But I wanted to like at least smile and know, and so that the other person that I'm interviewing like knows that, oh yeah, I'm also a real person and I'm trying to actively like listen to what they're saying. Because if you just like gave this really long, passionate answer about something and your interviewer just looks at you, nods, and then writes something down, you immediately start like draw back into your mind and you're just like, oh no, I said something wrong. I should have said something else. And it's just like very isolating to just see somebody nod and then like write something down and you have no idea what they're writing or anything.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a whole other discussion. If you are the interviewer, there's a whole onus on you to try really hard, put this person as much ease as they can, make them feel friendly, welcome, make them feel encouraged and supported, because otherwise they're not going to shine and you're not going to get a great interview. You won't be able to tell very fairly if they're good for the job or not.
Mm-hmm. That also goes along with what Ricky Witherspoon mentions, is about how you're allowed to end the interview early. If you're feeling like it's a really unproductive conversation, you've kind of thought you don't really want to join the team or you feel uncomfortable, you're not obligated to continue. And you can just be like, thank you so much for the opportunity. I think this isn't the right position, and leave.
I have never done that. I don't think I could see myself doing it. If it's really bad, if I thought this is an unfair interview, I'd probably tell them to their face, just to vent my own sort of childish emotions. Quite frankly, I think I'd probably tell them, "Why are you doing this? What's this? What's happening here? What's this for?" Just to their face, as opposed to just saying, "Oh, thank you very much," and walk out, which is definitely the more mature thing to do. Ricky's suggestion, you know, say this and then say, "Thank you very much. Just, I've got to go. Whatever. Not for me. Fine." I would probably be a bit more juvenile, let's say.
That scares me. So I would probably go through the rest of the interview and go cry and be like, why is this happening? But also probably then just not send a follow-up and not move forward with the next interview is probably what I would do.
Well, yeah, because you've dodged a bullet, right? It did not work out. I mean, assuming it's not you just completely muffing up all the questions, you know, if asking terrible questions or the environment's like really kind of feels negative, you know, they're really coming down you hard, it's not your fault, but it doesn't feel great anyway.
That goes with what Anum has said on, however, one thing that works every time for them is that mentioning that you're willing to put in 100% to learn, grow, and contribute. Because if something's just not going the way that you want, or they ask you, what's one thing you want us to know about you, like before we leave, is just mentioning that you are willing to learn and grow and contribute, because that's what any software developer is going to need to do. because our industry is constantly changing every single like year.
Yes.
And with that, Ellen Shapiro also mentions how admit when you don't know something instead of trying to bull your way through the answer.
Whoa, hold up. How did you make that sound with your mouth?
Oh, I just say whatever the I want. It just works.
Oh, that's very impressive skill. Well done for that. Both these answers really chime with something from Anum or Ellen. Chime with something that's in my head, which is that when someone says to you, how do you do thing X? How does, I don't know, Arc work in Swift or Objective-C or whatever? And if you aren't familiar with memory management in Swift, it's really quite dull, but you don't know it. Some folks will try and just make stuff up or kind of guess their way through an answer, and it sounds terrible. It never really works. You don't understand what's actually happening here. And so it's much better, like Anum said, and Ellen said, to say, I'm going to learn this. I don't know anything about Arc, but I'd love to learn, is better than sort of like 2 or 3 minute random wandering rant around the topic of Arc and similar that you don't really understand. So just say, I don't know, I would love to learn, because they can teach you that stuff. They can teach you, you know, Arc or macros, whatever it is that they're asking about in the first place, but they can't teach you how to learn, have a learning kind of personality. That's way harder to work on. So just be honest, get to the point and say, I want to learn.
Saying you want to learn, and you can also mention how you may have come across that term when researching something similar, like tangential to that topic too. You can say, like, I don't know what how memory management works, but I came across on like class instructs, and it goes with reference types and value types. And does that work with memory? And kind of like walk your way into the problem. And they can be like, oh yeah, it works similar to that. And it helps you like also just say, kind of just also not saying you don't know anything. Cause I mean, sometimes you do come across a term that you don't know at all, but knowing like something somewhat related to it, it can help keep the conversation going about them teaching you that topic too.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, Rob Whitaker's best advice is get some good sleep.
So that brings us to the end of the show. Hope you enjoyed it once again. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for subscribing. If you can, take a moment to leave a review below. And of course, tell your friends to subscribe. Next episode, our open ballot is going to be, should we use Swift everywhere, or is it better to learn other languages too? Until next time, folks, take care.
See ya.